The Bain Free Radio Hour.
Hello and welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour. Today, Sean Haslett sits down with anthology editors Casey Yazell, David Boop, Jamie Ibsen, and Jason Cordova to discuss the construction of anthologies from idea to final book. After that, we'll have more One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name, Part 55.
Welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour podcast. I'm your host, Sean Patrick Haslett. I'm here with Jamie Ibsen, Jason Cordova, David Boop, and the lovely Casey Yazell. Welcome, everyone.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's we're going to be talking anthologies, everything, soup to nuts about them. So let's start from the
nuts is correct. You have to be nuts to do an anthology.
That's true. You have to have a little bit of schizophrenia or be crazy to do some of this stuff. All right. So let's start at the very beginning. You have an anthology idea and you want to pitch it. Okay. What's your first step? And I'm just going to, well, let's just open it up. And then I'll randomly choose people from time to time.
Find out who else is nuts along with you.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yes. Yeah.
Nuts do tend to be packaged together.
Oh, go ahead, yeah. Casey.
I was going to say, so in my case, I believe very strongly in the power of friendship. And so I like to work my network connections when it comes to things like this. Yes, magic.
You just reminded me of the song Nightman from it's always what is it? It's always shine. I don't know. Something every day is something in Philadelphia. You know, that show, Dayman,
sure.
Nightman. I don't. Whatever. Just keep going. Friendship and everyone. Anyway, keep going. Sorry.
So no, that's okay.
There'll be one person that gets that, and no one else.
No, so in my case, I have the idea for the noir anthologies, and I was very new at Bain. I think I had like one story in a different Bain anthology that you know, my friend John Ringo had edited and invited me to contribute to. And so I was, you know, rank newbie, right? So I was like, well, if I just like randomly, you know, throw this at people, I don't know how useful that's going to be. So I was like, well, who do I know that I am friends with, that I can work things out with? And the answer was Larry Correa. So I did a panel, or I suggested a panel at LibertyCon that was related to the topic of the noir crossover anthologies that I wanted to pitch, and I knew Larry was going to be at LibertyCon that year. So I worked with programming to like suggest, hey, have him be on this panel. I'll moderate it. And I like went all out, right? Like I wore, you know, like the noir pencil skirt with the back seam stockings. The only thing I couldn't get in time was the birdcage veil, right? But like, I wanted to do this whole like femme fatale thing, right? To play it up. And we did the panel and it was very well attended, very well received. And we had a great time. And fortunately, this was sort of serendipity, but fortunately, immediately after that panel, we went to like a reception for, you know, people associated with the publisher offsite from LibertyCon, and Larry was there. So I kind of like sidled up and I was like, hey, thank you so much. You did such a great job on the panel. And he was like, yeah, that was a great panel. It was a great idea. I was like, yeah, you know, I love like, you know, your Grimnarr series and, you know, how we cross over, and man, wouldn't it be cool if we did an anthology? And he was like, yeah, I guess that'd be cool. I was like, well, what if I did it and you put your name on it and we make lots of money? And he was like, tell me more. so that's kind of how I sort of like, you know, femme fataled my way into editing anthologies.
It's not a bad idea. What about you, David? He never remembers this when I tell him this, but the first pitches that I did were based on like a template that David sent me like eons ago. He never remembers, yeah. But I will never forget. So same question, David, in terms of like, how do you approach this topic?
So Everyone has come about kind of differently, but the first one is the one that people most know the story about, and that's the straight out of Tombstone.
Ooh, didn't
And
know it.
that was just me, my mouth talking before my brain could think it through. I was on a panel with Jim Butcher, and it was on cross-genre detectives. And afterwards, I find myself walking down the hall of the convention with him, looking, struggling for something to say to him. And of course, I had published several Weird Westerns short stories at that time. And I said to him, I said, "Hey, Jim, some of your characters have been around a long time. Have any of them in the Old West?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah, I had a couple of characters that reference being in the Old West." And I said, "Well, have you ever thought about writing their story? I'm thinking of doing a Weird Western anthology." He goes, "I would love to do that." And he goes, "Yeah, reach out to me. I'll write you a story for it." And so then he walked away to go grab a flight home. And I'm standing there going, "Well, fuck, now I've got to put together a Weird Western anthology." I had absolutely no plans to do so before then.
Oops.
So I reached out to my mentors, and they were all happy to help, but I needed that one more big name. And again, we go to Larry Correia, and I'm in, I think it's Fantasy Con, or maybe it was Salt Lake City Comic Con or something. And I find myself in the green room across from Larry, and I said, "Hey, Larry, when did Monster Hunter International start?" And he goes, "Oh, well, it started, right after the Civil War, with Bubba Shackelford's Professional Monster Hunters." And I said, "Have you ever written the origin story for them?" And he goes, "No." And I said, "Would you like to?" He goes, "Well, I would love to, but it would have to be published by Bain because they have the rights to the Monster Hunter." And I said, "Well, as it so happens, I'm talking to Tony about publishing it." He goes, "Well, yeah, if Tony publishes it, then yeah, I'll do it." And I said, "Okay." So he walks away, and I go, "Now I got to find a way to talk to Tony and pitch her this anthology." So, as it so happens, I'm helping Kevin J. Anderson out at his booth at Dragon Con. He invites me up to what was then called the Barfly suite. And I find myself sitting next to Tony, who I'd met on a couple of occasions, and we're small talking. She goes, "Okay, enough small talk. What are you here to pitch?" And I said, "I have a Weird Western anthology." And she goes, "I don't think Bane is Weird Western." I said, "I have Larry Correia doing a Monster Hunter International origin story and Jim Butcher doing a Dresden File origin story." She looks at me and goes, "You know what? I think Bane is Weird Western." And that's basically how I ended up editing an anthology. And then it's just gone on from there. I've done 12 now. Three Weird Westerns, three Space Westerns, some pulp heroes. And stuff like that. So, and none of them have been the same. Every one of them has had a different pitch to it, different experience, and so forth.
Jason.
So I went about this all backwards. I was listening to music and we were goofing off online, social media. Casey was involved in this. Jamie was there when I was listening to Fall Out Boy's Thanks for the Memories. And I looked over on my bookshelf and there was an Esther Friesner anthology that said Fangs for the Mamrys. And I was like, oh my God, how did Bane miss out on that? Tanks for the Mamrys. You got tanks and hot chicks in them. And I'm joking. And so all of a sudden, my comment section blows up. I've got like 250 comments. And then out of nowhere, there's Tony Weisskopf. Pitch this to me. Like, oh, that was the fastest I'd ever sobered up in my life. Well, So I go to Esther Friesner and I was like, Esther, I don't I I've can I use the whole chicks idea? And she was like, yes, please. Oh, and I've got a great short story for you too. I was like, what's it called? She's like, Tread Softly. I was like, cool, great, awesome. I'll tell Tony you're involved. So I pitched it, had Esther involved immediately, which was key. But then later on it came time to actually like check with the author, say, hey, I've got the story. Esther said, what's this for? I was like, Esther, it's for the chicks in tank tops. She's like, I don't remember that. I was like, okay, tanks for the mammary. She's like, oh, that one, yes, that was great.
She's awesome. I love Esther. She's so cool. So
So
cool.
yeah,
she's going to give me a story for my next anthology. So
Oh, that's cool.
she's
That's
so good.
awesome.
I love her stuff. She had the wildest story in that anthology too. I was like expecting little sweet old lady with a nice little
Oh, no, not Esther.
But I got the I was fortunate enough to sit in with Janet Morris, who kind of tutored with Robert Asprin back in the day on how to build anthologies. And Janet Morris taught me how to build an anthology. So I knew the fundamentals of how to do it. I just never had done it because I don't want to be an editor. I want to be a writer. Well, it turns out I'm actually kind of halfway decent at editing anthologies too. I wasn't expecting that. So yeah, it just kind of fell into place. And then Larry and Tony approached me about editing the Monster Hunter Files Volume 2 with him out of the blue. I hadn't expected that. And then I've done two more anthologies with Bane since then. So.
Jamie.
For a while there, I was doing a lot of anthologies with CKP, and I had more ideas than I could punch out at once, and I just started making lists of ideas that we had bounced around on our usual Saturday evening video chat and stuff like this. And then Jason approached me to work with Hank for Depth Charge. And I had never worked with Hank. I'd never done an anthology with Bane before. And Depth Charge was its own thing because Hank has a mind like a steel trap when it comes to every science fiction short story written, as far as I can tell, between like 1930 and 1999. And that's about it. But if it's in there, he knows it, and he knows it well enough that he can like figure out what it was published in. And the trouble is that Hank's eyes don't work so hot no more, and so he needs a minion. And so I came on board as his minion. We literally were like searching through eBay, finding paper copies of old copies of like Asimov and stuff like that to physically get a copy of the printed story so that I could photograph the pages and OCR them in order to build the anthology with the stories that we wanted to include. And then we wrapped on Depth Charge, and I was having a final chat with Tony, and she basically said, "All right, so what else do you got?" Like, panic, huh? Well,
List.
I've got a list. And the top two ideas that I had boiled down to plausibly deniable and stories in the key of adventure. And stories in the key of adventure had problems with it in that the concept for it was like take a ballad or take a song, take a story being told through music, and then use that as the inspiration for the short story, right? One of my favorite headcanon nonsense things when it comes to stories is that Toto's Africa is actually like about a dude who's contracted werewolfism and is down in Africa trying to figure out how to undo it, right? That kind of
It's on
thing,
my top five favorite list of top
right?
five favorite songs about werewolves.
Yeah, exactly. And so I had this like I started like figuring out like, oh, it'd be really cool if we could do this song and that song and those kind of thing. And I'm like, this is going to be a nightmare copyright wise. This is not such a hot idea after all. It's great in theory, but when theory collides with reality, it's a problem. So
We
instead
can
we went with plausibly
yeah.
deniable and spies and spooks and mercenary mischief and Buff Orpington nonsense and all that good stuff is it ended up working out really, really well. And I hit up the usual suspects and got a whole bunch of yeses, a couple of noes, and yeah, so there it is. And then one of the other fun things that I got to do for Plausibly Deniable was Carol brought me on to do the title treatment after we got the art back from Kurt. So I got to play around with the front cover stuff too, not just the inside. So that was rad.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I don't know. My ring light's kind of messing it up there, but gorgeous cover.
Yeah, really
So,
pleased.
anyway.
If you
Good
want to
job, Jamie.
investigate that key one again, I can help you because I've worked with music rights and in fiction, and I know how you can do workarounds and stuff. So,
Maybe we should talk then. This is how
Yeah,
these
we
things
should
happen.
definitely talk. So, I mean, I
Cool.
my first novel, She Murdered Me, was science. And
Nice.
so yeah, I know of which I speak. So, but
Really?
yeah, let's talk.
Cool.
All right. So you get the yes on the pitch, and now you got to put this thing together. How do you think about constructing an anthology? What are some of the techniques you use? This time I'm just gonna start with Jason.
So I always figured you need one or two big names, at least one or two big names to carry the anthology to get people to actually look and say, oh, so and so's got a new story out. Great, I want this. And then from there, it's pretty much who do I know and I've read their stuff and I like their stuff enough where I can say, yeah, I really would like you in my anthology, and also who's got the free time. 90% of the authors I contact are like, I don't have time. And I was like, I understand, but the option's open if you do find a hole in your schedule. And then from there, it's just getting the authors together, and then once they get their stories in, make sure they fit, which I'm not always the best at following the guidelines of anthologies myself. Jamie can attest to that.
Don't know what you're talking about.
But then
I'm with
I
this, no.
approach the whole construction. Are we continuing with the construction, or are we just not there yet?
Oh,
Yes.
yeah, you can keep going. Yeah.
All right. So what I like to do is I do it in like a tent pole, and that I learned from Janet Morris, where I've got one of the biggest name stories leading off, one of the bigger names of the anthology leading off. But my personal, like, this is a story I really like, goes in the middle. And because that's the one, in my opinion, is propping up everything else. It's kind of coming like this, where you've got the beginning, the middle, and the end.
Yeah.
And you want those three stories in that. So it's like your three strongest stories, your three favorite stories that you like. And what that allows you to do also is if there's a newer author who's doesn't have the name recognition, you can slide them in with, and they fit, like you'll have like Jim Butcher and then David Boop. No, I mean, I'm not saying you're new, David. I'm just using as an example.
No, I get what you say. That's interesting because I was always told put the weakest story in the middle because people read the first story and the last story. And if they like the first story and the last story, then they'll go to the second story and work their way through, is what I was told.
So what when I first got the contract for Noir Fatale, Toni recognized that I had no clue what I was doing, Toni Weisskopf. And so she sent me an email. She was like, okay, sweetheart, here's what we're gonna do. And the way she broke it down for me was it very similar to what Jason said. She said, you need one third big names, one third mid-listers, one third new voices that no one's ever heard of, but that you're excited about. And I was like, okay, all right, I know the bottom category. I'll hit Larry up for the other two. And then she also said, you know, you want your strongest stories beginning, right in the middle, and at the end, and then kind of funnel in towards so that you're like buffering the weaker stories, you know, with those really strong stories. So I don't know. That's interesting that you and I have that same structure, Jason, but we got it from different sources. I suspect that. I mean, Tony and Janet probably
Well, they
at
worked
some
together
point had
way.
contact.
Oh, Bain used to publish Janet's Heroes and Hell stuff way back in the day. So
So maybe, I don't know. But
I think
anyway,
Janet taught that to Tony. So
it's entirely possible. But yeah, that's the way that I did it, and it worked pretty well for us. So, except that it was hard once we got all the stories in. Like, how do you choose which is best?
yeah, when you've got 10 stories and they're all like a 9.4 to a 9.6, like.
In my case, I always knew Larry was going to be our cleanup batter, right? Like we had agreed on that. Like Larry's story was going to be last always. But other than that, like, you know, who's better, David Weber or Laurel K. Hamilton? You know what I mean? I don't know. So.
Jumping back even before some of this, some things you have to decide when you're doing an anthology is first of all, are you going to be doing reprints or all originals? Are you going to do slush or are you going to do invite only? I am historically lazy. Reputation precedes me in my laziness, and I don't want to read slush. I'm reading slush right now as a favor for somebody. I don't want to do this again. I cannot stand reading slush. Luckily, it's a smaller group that's slushing it, and I'm not having to go through 300 stories.
There's another complication to that nowadays, right? Because it's not just slush, it's AI slop that's maybe mixed into slush. But anyway, I didn't mean to cut you off.
And that's valid. I tutor on the side, and I tutor college papers occasionally, and picking up all the AI in these college papers was easy at first, and now it's getting harder. Here's the weirdest catch I ever did on an AI. They had put in there, they had a quote that apparently came from the magazine of science fiction. There is no magazine of science fiction. It is called the magazine of science fiction and fantasy. And I said to the guy, did you have an AI write this? And he's like, and like, yeah, no, you're going to get expelled if you're caught. Go back and redo your references. So, I make these decisions. I almost always am going to do invite only because I want people I know that can submit a good story to me. And most of the time they do. My rejection rate is very, very little with invites. And usually that's only because the story does not fit with the anthology at all. And so as far as that goes. I haven't done reprints ever. This anthology I'm doing now for Bane is going to have one reprint. It's the first time I've done a reprint. But it's Larry Niven. So, and Larry Niven says you put a story in his anthology, you put the story in there. So,
what are the advantages and disadvantages of reprints? Somebody's got feedback.
Gone now. With Death Charge, one of the biggest problems that we had was tracking down who the agent was for the author that had been dead for 20 years. That was a trick. And sometimes it's not nearly so difficult. It's difficult emotionally, but we have one reprint in Plausibly Deniable, because Jack Clemens wrote one short story ever. And I bugged him for years afterwards, like, dude, this is good. This is good. You are streetsy. You spin a tale. You are tremendous at this. This is the most hard-hitting cyberpunk story I've ever read. And this was for my very first anthology that I ever did. And the way that it goes out is just, oh, wow. And then he passed. Right, he had a stroke, and then he was gone, and the world was a sadder place. And so, Plausibly Deniable is dedicated to him. I reached out to his mom, and asked for permission to include it because honestly, like that story and a couple of the other stories from that first We Dare anthology was one of the genesis ideas for Plausibly Deniable in general. And so Sharon was lovely and wonderful, and she was absolutely keen to see Jack's name on the cover again, And so we were able to include Bagman, and that was terrific. So in that sense, it's just like, here is the story. It's finished. It isn't going to be late. And then, you know, we slot it in and away we go. With Depth Charge, it's reaching out to agents and asking for permission and then getting back like their 3-page form letter demanding, you know, this many thousands of dollars to include this story that was printed back in the 60s. And I'm like, you know, maybe we don't need your story quite that hard and write them off and move on to somebody who's going to be a little bit more reasonable and stuff like that. But again, with reprints, you know, they're timely. If you can, you know, the hardest part is getting the permission, and then it's just like, all right, well, what order are we going to put these in? And yeah, boom, 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 you line it up, you know. And that was when I was putting together Plausibly Deniable, you know, I mean, there's no weak stories in the entire thing, I think. The trick was I didn't want it all to feel like it was the same tale, right? Like with spook nonsense and with mercenaries that are being deniable ops and stuff like that. There's enough of a playground there that we had like a modern day CIA contractor who got betrayed by her team down in South America, and then she had to ally with a mobster in order to, get the mission done and make it back home safe. And when Casey and Nick turned in that story, it was tremendous. But that was the only really modern story that I had. Then we've got the Holos, who are writing 10 or 20,000 years into the future with cyborgs running around infiltrating spaceships. And then we've got Spy versus Spy versus Spy with Jason and Melissa. It was a real mix. And so my plan when I laid out the interior order of all the stories in Plausibly Deniable was each story should feel distinct because it shouldn't feel like the story that preceded it.
Can I
Yeah.
ask a
We had
follow-up
a
question? No, go ahead, Casey.
I was going to say we had a similar sort of consideration when we did the noir anthologies, because we specifically wanted to showcase the ways in which these noir themes would intersect with science fiction and fantasy to include urban fantasy. So it seemed like for each volume, and it was different each time, right? So for one volume, we'd get a lot of science fiction stories and very few fantasy stories. And then for the next one, we'd get a lot of fantasy stories and very few science fiction stories. So trying to make sure that we had a mixed balance, one of the things that Larry did that was very smart was he would wait until we had all of the stories in, and then he'd be like, okay, Casey, what do we need? And so that's why we have, a grim noir story for the first one, a Lost Planet homicide story for the second one, and then an MHI story for the third one, is because we were able to sort of like balance it out using his story, which worked out well. And then, I mean, I kind of did that a little bit too, but I usually started mine earlier because I was receiving the stories when people, would send them in. So, and then once I had them all, then I would tell him what we needed.
So my follow-up question was about pitching, like having pitches sent in before the story, so you know what kind of story they're writing. Some of my anthologies I've done pitches with, and some I have not. What do you guys find? Have you guys done pitches first on your anthologies, and how well has that worked? Or
Not for me, not per se. I did what I did in my invites for the noir anthologies is I sent out an invite letter that explained what the theme was of the anthology, that we were looking for science fiction or fantasy. And then like I asked them to respond with a series of answers to questions. One of the questions was, are you in? The second question is, okay, what kind of story would you like to write? And if it was like, for example, when I sent the pitch to my pitch to invite him, the invite pitch to David Weber, I specifically said, we would love to have an honorverse story from you for this, but if you'd rather do something else, we're open to it. Just let me know. And so we kind of tailored it that way, if that makes sense.
what about the rest of you
Yeah.
guys? Do you guys have used pitches?
What I
Really?
typically would do is I would just ask for a I would kind of do similar to what Casey did, send out an invite with all the details, and then I would ask them to send me a log line, like just one word, one sentence that explained what they would be writing about. And the reason I did that is if you have an anthology, you don't want seven stories about the same thing, and then you're kind of stuck. So it gives you, the author doesn't have to commit too much, right? So if they're a famous author, they don't, like, if you tell them to do a pitch, they're just gonna be like, bro, I don't have time. No. Where you do a log line, it's like, okay, I can write a sentence, dash it off really quickly.
Yeah, for a pitch, for me, it's just like two lines. So I'm not asking for a synopsis. But yeah, I mean, when I got to the second and third volumes of the space of the Weird Westerns, I started asking for pitches because I was starting to see a lot of the similar kind of stories. I didn't want like a bunch of werewolf in the Old West stories and things like that. So, it allowed me to kind of separate them out between the two volumes because I was doing them simultaneously. And then for the space westerns, I asked for pitches, and it allowed me to basically say, okay, this is going to fit with what I'm building here. So, yeah, it depends. But I like pitches actually, and so yeah, I was curious if any of you like them.
As a writer, when I'm invited to an anthology, I will often find myself giving like a little mini pitch back to the editor. I did that with Jamie because I really, really wanted to be part of Plausibly Deniable, but I was also under several deadlines at the time. So I wrote back to Jamie and said, "Hey, I want to play in your party, but can I bring a friend?" And I sort of, pitched the idea of a co-author, really. And it ended up being Nick Stevenson, who Jamie knows and has written with and stuff. So, from that sense, as a writer responding to anthology invites, a lot of times I will do like a mini pitch or log line type situation, like, "Hey, we're thinking about this kind of story. I want to write it with this person," et cetera.
And knowing who you wanted to bring on board made it an awful lot easier to say
Sure.
yes. You know, if it
Yeah.
was
Yeah.
you collecting yet another pilot friend to come write, then I would have been like, well, I don't know. Have they written stuff before? And you'd be like, no, I'm sure it'll be fine, though. I'd be like,
But have I been wrong yet, Jamie? Have I been wrong
No,
yet? Okay
no,
then.
no.
Oh,
But I mean, like, you know, Plausibly Deniable also had the very first time I ever had to just outright reject a story because it didn't fit the theme at all. And Jason and I got into it a little bit because I was looking for spy nonsense and I got Marines getting into nonsense on shore leave. And I'm like, so this doesn't fit like at all. And I don't know what to tell you other than now I want to do a shore leave anthology. But you know, he and Melissa put together a very different Bronze Legion story instead. And then when I saw Jason, you know, celebrating the power of spite because he and Melissa were able to write a story in like 3 days and it was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean it worked out. But
That's like win-win-win.
yeah, I could
Yeah.
probably, you know, implement a you know, give me some kind of an idea of what you're going to be working on so that I don't waste your time 10,000 words later.
Yeah.
Because I felt bad for going like,
Yeah.
look, I love the story. The story's fantastic. It's a lot of fun. It's nonsense. It's mischief. It's great. It's not spies. It's not mercenaries. And it's not even remotely close to what I sent you when I sent you the pitch that I gave to Tony. And Jason's like, what, you mean you wanted me to read that? I'm like, dude.
Don't feel bad. Don't.
I okay, that bus, those treads on that bus really hurt.
Don't.
I know.
So I'm just
Jamie,
let into my
I'm only
defense
saying
here.
it because you're here to defend yourself.
In my defense, you had me read the first part and not the entire pitch. Because I read the first part, I was like, yeah, that looks great. I think Tony will be fine with it.
Yeah.
I didn't expect to be invited into this anthology. So I didn't retain the information until later when you said, hey, what about that short story for the anthology? I was like, oh yeah, sure, I could do that. Plausibly deniable, right? Yeah, I could do that.
What was
Jamie,
it about? Send.
don't feel bad. Jason had to reject my initial story for Monster Hunter Files, which I
I
also
wasn't going
have
to
a
tell
copy
anybody
of.
that.
So I'll tell everybody. I don't care. Because I sent it in and he was like, this is a beautiful story, but it doesn't work with some of the deeper MHI lore. And so we kind of wrangled back and forth for a little bit. And then finally I was like, you know what? Just pull it, Jason. I don't, yeah, if the changes that you want me to make are gonna, mess with the integrity of the story too much. So if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. No harm, no foul. And he was like, well, give me something else. And so I don't know if it was the power of spite or I had just watched the Thomas Crown Affair or what, but I came up with the story that actually made it in. And I like it better, honestly. It,
You
you
wrote
know,
that in
it
5 days. I was shocked because you were still flying at the time when you wrote that, I thought.
I don't remember.
No, you just moved up north.
Yeah.
What it
Yeah,
was.
but it was the story wrote it was very quick, and I had a lot of fun with it. So it all worked out in the end. But yeah, Jamie, don't feel bad for doing your job because Jason also does his.
Right. Okay. Very good.
Yeah, and we ended up selling that story to Bain anyway. So Bain still published it, just wasn't Jamie.
Well, this actually leads perfectly to the next question. No judgment, but there's judgment. I call it the flake coefficient. So, of the total number of people, let's say you have 10 slots for the anthology, how many people do you invite, knowing full well that authors being mercurial types, will not turn things on. let me go to the former Air Force officer who has military experience and probably has the same annoyance factor that I do with this thing. Go ahead.
So here's what I do. I invite 10 people and then I lay out a timeline relatively early on saying, okay, I need the story by this date. And then I pad that for myself internally for a little while, right? And give myself a second date. And if they still don't have the story done by the second date, I will tell them, I will reach out and be like, hey, it doesn't look like this is going to happen. If you know, can you have the story to me in 2 days? If not, then, you know, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I fully understand your life is, you know, crazy, whatever's going on, right? Like, I try not to judge because we all know shit goes bad wrong sometimes, right? And, you know, people struggle with illness. And
you're much nicer than I am. Not my problem. I will never invite you again if you flake, because I give you plenty
of
time.
I might not invite them again, but I also try not to engage my emotions about it because I have better things to do with my energy. So I'm like, okay, well, thank you. If it doesn't work, thank you so much. I appreciate you, you know, vaya con Dios. And then I reach out to I don't think I'm using this term properly, but it's the only one that's in my head right now. My bag men, right? Like my dudes, my friends, and they're not all men. They're a lot of them are women, but they're the ones that I can be like, hey girl, I need 8,000 words by Friday. Can you get me something? And they'll be like, yeah, got you. You know, Chris Kennedy is a perfect example. Chris Kennedy these people know that they're my like go-tos for, I need something quick and good to meet a deadline. And I appreciate them and I love them and I shower them with gifts and they have saved, because they have saved my ass. Yeah, that's my philosophy. Again, I like to attack my problems with the power of friendship. So I make friends and I make them my bag men. And then when the problem, you know, when a problem arises, I reach out. Be like, hey man, need a solid.
What I've done in the past is my it would be great to have this person and I know that they would turn in a great story, but they will probably say no. They get the invites first.
And now, as promised, one jump ahead. John Moore is a nanotech-enhanced soldier of fortune. Lobo is an AI, a living weapons and intelligence platform of enormous destructive potential. Two very dangerous wolves in a galaxy of deadly corporate and paramilitary predators. But Moore has grown weary of the killing, and just once he'd like to finish a job without leaving a trail of blood behind him. Not going to happen. Not on a pristine planet called Mackin, where two gigantic corporations vie for control of the local jump gate and access to the riches of an undeveloped world. Dealing with a kidnapping and extortion scheme is only the beginning for Moore and Lobo as they work to stay one jump ahead.
At the appearance of the number, I set my time mark for 90 minutes. I sipped water from the tube built into the suit. I wanted the Zycheck security detail heading toward the inspection to be far enough away that when the estate team yelled for help, I could be sure none would arrive before we'd finished and escaped. Zycheck's air support was, according to Gustafson, both minimal and the first thing on the inspection list, so unless something went wrong, we should be able to count on at least one clear hour from the mission start. That should be more than enough, I hoped. I settled in yet again and tried not to look too much at the light green countdown on my display. 89 more minutes. The timer wound to zero, turned red, and reversed direction, now displaying the elapsed mission time. We were on. My faceplate's copy of Lobo's forward video feed turned into a blur as he accelerated first downward and then at full speed as he skimmed the treetops toward the estate. The sensors would pick him up, but his low flight path would buy a second or two, and that was all we needed. After 5 seconds of approach, Lobo fired three small missiles at the gate on his side of the estate, then abruptly changed course and headed up, back, and away from the target, reacting as if he'd been unwilling to face the defense systems. Each of Lobo's missiles merved a second and a half after launch, changing from three fat tubes into a dozen slender rockets. The estate's automated defense systems did the best they could, but the hole our recon had suggested might exist in them proved to be real. The air defense portion was designed for targets above 200 meters, and Lobo had never been that high while in range of those weapons. The ground and low-altitude automated systems were solid enough for civilian or typical corporate attack squad weaponry, but Lobo's mil-spec rockets overpowered them easily. By the time the defense system launched its three interceptors, it was facing 12 oncoming missiles. 10 hit their targets. Via the relay of Lobo's long-distance video sensors, I watched as two missiles turned the entire gate area into a cloud of smoke, and the remaining 8 hit the dirt along a 100-meter-wide section of ground with the gate at its center. A split second after impact, those 8 blew. A mountain of dirt and rock and small vegetation soared into the air and buried the gate and a long stretch of the wall on either side of it. The roar of the explosions shook the air. The helmet's audio system compensated quickly, lowering the volume, then readjusting as the sounds died. No one in the estate would be coming out of that gate anytime soon. I pushed the magnification on the Lobo relay as far as it could go. But even with the best interpolation the faceplate's processors could manage, I couldn't see if any people were moving around. Lobo was too far away for his original feed to carry that level of detail. I'd insisted on an approach that gave the gate guards a chance at living, because I wanted this to be as non-lethal an attack as possible. My lack of information was the price of that insistence. No time to worry about that now, though. I fought to control the adrenaline surged that begged me to regard the people in the estate as just so many more bodies, moving but already dead and not knowing it, existing only for us to finish them. Lobo had already fired a second burst, this time a barrage of 10 small missiles carrying transmission-clogging comm webs, thousands of grain-sized modules that detected all active transmissions in their range and broadcast garbage across every in-use frequency. We'd set the cloggers to skip the hobbyist niche we were using and focus on the standard military and commercial bands. We risked our transmissions being recorded and decrypted if a civilian with a snooping hobby happened to be targeting the estate, but we'd kept the chatter down and our encryption was strong, so the risk was minimal. 6 of the missiles made it through the defense systems and sprayed their sensors across the estate before hurtling into the ground just outside it. "Team 1, first group heading your way," said Lobo in my left ear. "One vehicle, 5 humans, no way to tell if target is among them." "Got it, Lim." "Team 1, in case anyone did record and decrypt our comm," said in my right ear. "Drank 'em. Don't kill 'em," I said. "Already understood," she said, "but the roads are murder." She'd taken great joy in pointing out that if Zychek didn't armor its vehicles very well, our plan would kill everyone in them. I had no answer for her, other than my belief that the vehicles would be strong, a belief born of the respect I developed for Zychek's security squad during the time Lobo and I had monitored them.
"Team 2, second group, heading your way," Lobo said. "Also, 1 vehicle, 5 humans, and no way to tell if target is among them."
"Moving to position," I said. I threw off the blanket and sprinted to my second mark, a level spot behind a tree where I would have a good view of anyone trying to get away from the vehicle. I pulled a second camo blanket off the 2 guns I'd previously placed there and aimed at the gate, and settled into sniper position in front of the bigger one.
"Second group has reversed course and headed for rear exit," Lobo said.
We'd hoped the teams would split and take advantage of the multiple exit points, so our plan focused on that option. If the second team stayed with the first after what was about to happen, we'd know the first team had Chung, and Lim would have to hold them both until Lobo could get there. I maintained my position. Lim had the best data on the action at her end, so it was up to her to make the call whether I should join her. The first Zychek team reached the rear of the estate. My relay of Lim's display showed the escort vehicle jetting out of the barely open gate. Lim blew half her mines a second after the vehicle cleared the gate. The display image turned fuzzy with smoke. As the processors filtered the visual noise of the dust,
The feed in my faceplate cleared enough to show the black vehicle flipping end over end in the air several times before it crashed to the road. Enough of the vehicle's internal systems were intact that it extruded disaster struts and righted itself.
This has been the Bane Free Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us at the heart of science fiction. Join us next week as we continue with part two of Sean Haslett's interview of anthology editors Casey Azell, David Boop, Jamie Ibsen, and Jason Cordova. After that, we'll have more One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name, part 56.